We are in Matthew chapter 12 tonight. We're plugging away through the book of Matthew. Interesting bit of trivia. Of the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, a lot of people just automatically assume that Matthew's the biggest one because it has more chapters than the others. But, in fact, Luke is longer than Matthew, even though it has 24 chapters while Matthew has 28. They're longer chapters. So Luke is actually about 4 or 5 pages longer in my Bible. May not be in yours that much difference. Depends on the print size and the page size and so forth. But I just thought that would be an interesting note for you. If you remember that Jesus had sent the disciples off in chapter 10 on their limited commission, as we often refer to it, and while they were off doing that, he had gone around some other villages and teaching and healing and doing those things. And now we pick up in chapter 12 and they're back together again. There's no record in Matthew of them coming back and of anything that they did while they were out there at this time. They just suddenly, he sent them off, and then for a chapter they were nowhere to be found, and now in chapter 12, there they are again. It's the Sabbath day in chapter 12 and verse 1. They're walking through a field. And they were hungry. It's interesting, isn't it, that Jesus, the master of the universe, the creator of the universe, would allow his disciples to get hungry? Well, yes, sometimes people assume that if there's a problem in their life, then God has abandoned them, or God's not providing for them, or what have you. But that's not the case. God allows times of want as well as times of plenty. Paul talked about that. He talked about the fact that he had learned how to be content, whether he was in want, in need of things, or whether he had everything and abounded. He still learned to depend on God and trust that God knew what he was doing and knew what was right and would do what was right. And so, as they're walking through this field, the King James says a field of corn. Other translations say a field of grain. Probably wasn't corn as we know it, seeing how that was kind of an Indian crop that they had here in the New World. But perhaps barley, perhaps rye, perhaps some sort of a grain like that that would have the head on it and would have the little grains in it. And they just reached down and plucked some of those heads off and got the little grains out and ate them. Well, if you want to know what it's like to be nitpicked, look at Jesus and the Pharisees. The Pharisees were constantly watching him. And when they couldn't be watching him, they would send some spies to watch him. There was always somebody watching Jesus to try to find something wrong to accuse him of. On this occasion, it actually is the Pharisees themselves. As they're, who's going to go follow somebody out in a field? But that's what they were doing. They were wandering around following him. I would think they would have had something better to do. But all they seemed to have to do was investigate Jesus and see what he was doing and try to find something wrong with what he was doing. And so these Pharisees see that. They see, look what they did. Sometimes we're kind of like those Pharisees. We always, look, so-and-so's doing it. We run around like little private investigators, always trying to find out everybody else's wrongdoing. We've got to watch out. It's easy. It's easy to want to pick at everybody else's faults. It's easy to find theirs. It's a lot harder to find my own. It's always easier to see somebody else's problems and mistakes than it is to see our own. And yet, our own many times are the ones that are actually the problem, and that's the case with the Pharisees. Jesus and his disciples weren't the problem here. The Pharisees were. The Pharisees complained that they've broken the Sabbath law. Now, the Sabbath law was quite strict as God gave it. He was serious under the law of Moses about this day of rest. So much so that he said, hey, you're going to take a day of rest or you're going to die if you don't. And he didn't mean you'd have health problems. He meant you were to be executed if you didn't take a day off every week. Now, some of us might could learn that it is good to take a day off sometimes. We seem to go, push ourselves maybe too hard sometimes. And a day of rest can actually help us to be more productive on the other days of work. So maybe we need to learn that lesson. But under the law of Moses, it was a command that you take that. In fact, you know, we look back at the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20. That was one of the Ten Commandments. You know, he only had 10 rules that he gave the whole nation right there. And one of them was, you take one day off every week. And he, of course, specified which day, the seventh day, that was called then the Sabbath day. And in Exodus 20 and verse 10, it explains that even the slaves were not to work on that day. So it wasn't just the rich people got a day off while everybody else had to work for the rich people. That wasn't the way it worked. Everybody. He said, you know, not your servants. He didn't even want the animals, you know, those pack mules and the oxen that pulled the carts and pulled the different plows and things. Even they were supposed to get the day off. Everybody got the day off, and even the animals got a day off. So the debate then began, probably from the very time that Moses came down the mountain with that command not to do any work, as to, okay, what's work? What is work? I know there's a scientific definition that work is energy put in and it causes motion, causes something to be accomplished. And so that's work. Well, but they had these ideas. They argued about it. In some of the Jewish writings, the different rabbinical teachers would argue back and forth about what you could and couldn't do without violating the Sabbath day. They got pretty ridiculous with it, in fact, to the point that it's actually been said that some of them even got to the point that they said, on the Sabbath day, when you, as soon as, of course, it would start on Friday evening when the sun went down. And so that Friday evening when the sun went down, they said, you have to be in your bed and lay down. When the sun goes down, you stay in that bed. You don't get up out of the bed. All day, Saturday, the Sabbath day, you don't get out of bed. Some of them even went so far as to say, don't even open your eyes, because opening those eyelids, that's work. You're expending some energy. Well, at that point, they had gotten to the point where they had missed the whole point of the law. The law was to get them to take a day off of their regular manual labor, not just to have a day where you just laid in bed all day. But there were a few things that were specified. When the manna came, as they were out in the wilderness, they were not supposed to go out and look for it on the Sabbath day because God wasn't going to send it that day. And on top of that, on the sixth day, on Friday, they were supposed to go out and get whatever they were going to get, and they were supposed to go ahead and cook whatever they wanted for the Sabbath day, for the seventh day. They were supposed to go ahead and cook that and have it ready to eat. They got to eat leftovers on the Sabbath day because they weren't supposed to cook. In fact, it says they weren't supposed to kindle a fire. That could have been pretty tough in the wintertime when it was cold. You better get your fire started on Friday and make sure there's plenty of wood there to keep it going. In fact, that was one of the first cases in Mosaic law was a fellow who on the Sabbath day was out picking up some sticks for a fire. And they caught him picking up the sticks, and they took him to Moses and said, Moses, what do we do with this guy? We caught him picking up sticks. Moses said, oh, I don't know. Let me ask God. God came back and said, stone him to death. God was serious about this law. If you don't work, you'll be put to death. If you work on that day that you're not supposed to work, you'll be put to death, is what it said. So, if the disciples were really guilty of breaking the Sabbath law, there was a serious penalty coming here. And I'm sure the Pharisees were ready to exact that penalty. And oddly enough, I bet they wouldn't have had any trouble easing their consciences about picking up stones and stoning somebody on the Sabbath day. Even though that itself probably would have been a greater violation of the idea than what they're accusing the disciples of. Well, Jesus tries to explain to them that they weren't breaking the law. Eating was not breaking the law. It was okay to eat on the Sabbath day. Remember, we told her that when they had the manna, they were supposed to go ahead and cook what they wanted for the Sabbath day. They could eat it on the Sabbath day. They just weren't supposed to cook. They weren't supposed to do the work to prepare it. Just eat it. And so them, if they had gotten that grain and ground it down into flour and, then take it and made bread out of it and baked it in the oven, well, then they would have been violating God's Sabbath law. But as they were just going through and plucking some things off of the grain and eating it right there was not anything that violated the law. In fact, in verse 7, Jesus says they were guiltless. He didn't say they were excused. He didn't say, I'm going to be merciful and let it go this time or anything like that. He said they were guiltless. He said they didn't break the law. So, what do the Pharisees do about that? Verse 3, they're grumbling and complaining about what's going on, and so Jesus has to give them some teaching. And what he's going to do here in the next few verses is he's going to point out just what big hypocrites they really are. First, he starts by pointing to David. And he starts in verse 3 by saying, "Have you not read?" Now, this came up in class, and I think we may have covered it a little bit, but I want to go back over it again. A lot of people claim that the literacy rate, nobody knew how to read. Jesus expected that they knew how to read. He said, "Haven't you read it? Don't you know how to read?" In fact, it was a part of the requirement of God's law that was given by Moses that they know how to read and write. Because one of the things that was told them in Deuteronomy 6:9, as part of the thing they were supposed to do, was not only learn His commands, but there were certain ones that they were supposed to write down on the doorpost to their house. You see, you couldn't be a good Israelite and keep God's law if you couldn't read and write, because you wouldn't be able to keep that command. So, I have a feeling that those folks who think that the Jews couldn't read and write are sadly mistaken. God commanded of them that they read and write. Now, I know there were professional scribes, and I'm sure, like today, some of us don't write real well. We're not professional authors or professional writers, but we can write, kind of. Some of us, it can even be read by somebody else. Some of us can even read our own writing. And then there are people like Don who has to read chicken scratch that you can't even figure out whether that's really letters and numbers and words or what on there. So, that's a whole different issue. I think that's why a pharmacist had to go to school for so long so they can learn how to read doctors' handwriting. That's it, isn't it? Yeah. So, but they knew how to read, and he expected that not only did they know how to read, but they had read the Bible. That these were the religious leaders, not just the common man, but even the common man. We see Peter, he was a fisherman. He wrote a book of the Bible. John was a fisherman too. He wrote 5 books of the Bible. And so, we see these things that even these folks that supposedly were just common laborers, they knew how to read and write. We have this tendency in our society today to think we're so cultured and we're so advanced and everybody that came before us was so backwards. Remember, and part of that comes from the concepts of evolution. That's part of where that comes from. This idea that these guys, and they were so, they couldn't even talk, and then they learned to talk, and then on and on, and we advanced. The fact of the matter is, we haven't really advanced. We've actually declined in our use of our brain power and our knowledge. You know what Adam did the first day after he was created? He named all of the animals. Now, I don't know about you, but I can't name all of the animals. I couldn't name half the animals. I can't even name the animals at the zoo. I go, what is that animal? I don't know what that one is. But Adam named them all within just a few hours of being created. He's a pretty smart fellow. And within just a few generations there in Genesis, you read about people who created or invented musical instruments, who worked in brass and iron and other metal work. This wasn't something that happened over thousands and thousands of years. This happened within just a couple of generations of the creation. So, you know, evolution's got so many things backwards that it's quite scary. But nonetheless, here we are, the Jews being expected to read, expected to have God's knowledge, because that was the way that they were going to please God. So he looks at him and he says, haven't you read about David? Now David, now, since we're not Jews, we kind of take a little different view of David than the Jews did. You know, we look at David and we see his good points, and we see his faults, and he had plenty of faults. But to the Jewish people, oh, David was, I mean, he was their hero. He could do no wrong. I'm sure some of them had even figured out how it was okay for him to do what he did with Bathsheba and Uriah. I'm sure they had excused that in some way. But in this case, Jesus points to a different era of his life, one long before that, when he was running from Saul and he stopped with his men, his army, and they were hungry and they needed some food. And he went to the priest, and the priest said, well, I don't have any bread here. And David says, well, you know, what about, you've got that bread on the showbread table there in the tabernacle. He said, you know, it's time to take that off. You've got to put new bread out of it. He said, well, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's not special anymore because you're taking it off the table now. Couldn't we eat that? And the priest went along with that. Jesus makes it clear in verse 4 that it was not lawful for him to eat that bread. He broke the law. He broke God's law by eating the bread that only the priests were supposed to eat. And the priest, I'm sure, broke the law as well by allowing him to eat the bread that only the priests and the priest's family were supposed to eat. The things for the tabernacle were for the priests and their families. They weren't to be given to others. And David wasn't a priest, and he wasn't from a priestly family. He wasn't from Levi. He was from Judah. And so Jesus makes no bones about it. He says, you know your hero David? He broke the law. What about him? And he's pointing out their hypocrisy. Because they completely ignored David's faults. But here they want to jump on these folks who hadn't done anything wrong. That's a sad situation when we get to that point where we will overlook sin in one person's life and then accuse someone else of sin when they haven't even done anything wrong. But sometimes we get to feeling that way. Sometimes we'll overlook and ignore an awful lot with the people we're close to, and yet we're quick to jump to conclusions about somebody over there that, well, I bet, you know what, I bet they're up to no good. We don't even know what they're doing. But we just assume they're up to no good. And whereas it's a friend that actually is up to no good, with it, well, you know, they had a rough upbringing. They had a hard life. As though that excuses them doing something that's wrong. We've got to watch out for that type of attitude. Well, let's move along. David ate that bread. And then Jesus pulls out another example. And this example was a case of someone who actually broke the Sabbath law. The law was nobody was to work on the Sabbath. But you know, there was somebody who worked every Sabbath day in the nation of Israel and never got in trouble for it? Yeah, that's right, the priest. There were daily sacrifices that had to be made. And the Sabbath was no excuse. In fact, sometimes on the Sabbath days, they had to make extra sacrifices. More than usual. They had to work harder on the Sabbath day than they did on the other days. And so Jesus pulls that out. He says, what about this? Here's these priests. They're in the temple. They're in the tabernacle. You know, They're offering these sacrifices on the... They're kindling a fire. Sabbath law clearly says, don't kindle a fire. And yet here they are. You know, they get their censer and they come over here and they start the fire and they have the burnt offering there and the burnt sacrifice. Oh, they're violating that law. Well, why? Because they're keeping a greater law. God had commanded them to offer those sacrifices as well. So you got to... Here's the tricky part. We like to think, well, God said it, it's a command. True? Did you know that to some degree in some of these, there's a hierarchy of commands. Some commands are greater commands than others. Some commands take precedence. There's an order of operation. I don't know if you ever study enough in math. I hope so. Maybe the little ones hadn't yet. But, you know, in math, there's a hierarchy of the addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. When you get a big old problem, and you know, you've tried to forget those, I know, you tried to block them out, but you know, get that big old problem, it's got all these, this times that, and minus that, and divided by that, and plus this, and you go, what do I do with that thing? And there's an order of operations in mathematics that you follow, so that you get the right answer. If you don't follow it, you get the wrong answer. So if you have 7 times 4 plus 3, you have to do the multiplication before you do the addition or you get the wrong answer. Because if you do 7 times 4, that's 28, and then add 3, you get 31. But if you go back there and do it wrong, if you do the addition first, you get 4 plus 3, that's 7. 7 times 7 is 49. There's a big difference in 31 and 49. And so there's an order to those things. Well, God's laws are the same way. God had some laws that took precedence over other laws. And in this case, His laws to worship Him and to bring the offerings and the sacrifices that they were supposed to do was above the law to keep the Sabbath day. That law was more important than the other one. So the people that were responsible for keeping this law had to break this law to keep that one. You know, we see that all the time. Wait, there's a speed limit out here, right? I think so. Sometimes I see people up and down there, you'd wonder. But then I see the blue lights and I'm reminded. Almost every day I see blue lights up and down this road. But you know, sometimes you may see a police car with its lights flashing and you know it's going faster than that speed limit. Now, it used to be more so than it is now. A lot of times they really kind of cracked down on this. But they used to, you know, you'd see the ambulance. And it might be 75 miles an hour heading to the hospital because it's an emergency, right? Or you'd see the fire truck. You know, boom, 65 miles an hour, even though it's only 30 miles an hour. You know, they're trying to get to that fire to put it out, save somebody's life or what have you. They're breaking that speed limit law because there's a greater law. In effect, they're trying to save life. Or there's something going on that, you know, that's some sort of emergency that law is ignored under those circumstances. It's not as important as the other law. And that's the way it is. In fact, Jesus Himself said, the first and great commandment. He said there was one that was above the others. They weren't all equal. And so we can understand that there are some that take precedence over others. And in this case, the keeping of the sacrifices and the offerings in the temple took precedence over the keeping of the Sabbath day. And so Jesus uses that as an example to them too. And then Jesus goes on to explain, if the temple and the worship in the temple was more important than the Sabbath day, He says, there's one here, He's talking about Himself, that's greater than the temple. Of course He was. He's God. God's the only one that could be greater than the temple and the temple worship that God had commanded. Only God. And so Jesus says, I'm greater than the temple. And then in verse 7, He refers back to Hosea 6:6, which talks about God's desire for mercy. And you know why David didn't die? It wasn't because he didn't break the law. It's because God's mercy. But he said, you know, if you'd had the right kind of mercy, you never would have condemned these individuals who are
innocent. They're guiltless. They hadn't even done anything wrong. And you're condemning them.
Jesus said, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy," in the Sermon on the Mount. In James 2 and verse 3, it says that those who show no mercy will receive no mercy. We need to understand the importance of mercy. When we look to want to find fault, and remember what we said back at the beginning, the problem wasn't in Jesus and His disciples, the problem was in the Pharisees and their rabid desire to find fault with Jesus and His disciples. And if we get to that point where we're out to try to find problems, to try to find the wrong, looking for the bad instead of looking for the good, then the problem's not in the person where we try to find the bad. The problem's in our own hearts, in our own thoughts. And that's what we have to watch out for. And then verse 8, Jesus just puts the whole thing to rest with this statement. The Son of Man, again what He referred to Himself as, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. He said, I got the power to make the Sabbath law in effect or to just nullify the whole thing. And in fact, He did nullify the whole thing when He brought His new law. And as part of His new law, the Sabbath law does not exist. We're no longer under a Sabbath law like they were at that time. So Jesus proclaimed His power over the law of Moses and over the Ten Commandments. He was above it all. Well, there's this hierarchy again. You had the Sabbath law. You had the temple. You had Jesus is greater than the temple. Jesus can do whatever He wanted to do because He was God. But I'm sure they didn't understand all of that. Well, then in verse 9, He goes to the synagogue. Still the Sabbath day. This is equivalent to us coming to church on a Sunday. That was their version of church. They would go to the synagogue and they would be reading from the scriptures and they would sing songs and they would be taught and they would get together and talk and things like that too. And so it's kind of like us coming to church, and that's what they were doing. And Jesus went, and here it is. The Pharisees are still trying to find some fault with Him. And so they ask Him about healing on the Sabbath day. Was it okay to heal somebody on the Sabbath day? You know, we talked about this morning, those who call good evil and evil good. These Pharisees were a lot like that. They had completely missed the boat. They would rather see somebody suffer for an extra day than to see them healed on the Sabbath day. And that's a terrible thing. Jesus hits them close to home as He points out this hypocrisy, though. He says, which of you, see, He points it right, what man of you, would any of you do this? He said, if you've got a sheep and it falls in a hole and it's the Sabbath day, what are you going to do? You say, oh, it's the Sabbath day, I've got to rest today, I'll come back and get it tomorrow if it's still there. Well, no. Well, you'd go get the thing out of the pit. You'd get it out of the hole. They would. For a sheep. Now, what would we do for, a pet? Ooh, then we'd go to the ends of the earth for a pet. But that, even for a sheep, they wouldn't want to lose that thing if they left it in the pit. You know, maybe it broke its leg when it fell down there, and it might be dead by tomorrow. And or maybe a lion or something would get in there and get it. So we can't just leave it there. We got to get it out of there. And so they'd get it out. And so Jesus points out to them their hypocrisy, because here they are asking Him if it's okay to help a man out of a pit on the Sabbath day when they know good and well they'd do the same thing for a sheep. It's sad, isn't it, when they have that much compassion for an animal but they don't have that kind of compassion for a human being. And so Jesus asks them a loaded question in verse 12. He says, how much better is a man than a sheep? Now think about that question for a minute. What he really is saying is, okay, we know a sheep is not worth as much as a man. That's what he really said. So if you'd help the sheep, then of course we'd help the man. But see, in the Pharisees' way of thinking, the sheep is more valuable than the man. That sounds like some people today too, who will sacrifice a human life to save an animal life. Now, I like animals, especially like cows because they taste real good. But other animals too,
I like animals, even living animals. You know, they're fun. Pets are great. Dogs and cats and birds and all sorts of things. You know, people keep as pets, and that's fine. But at the end of the day, we have to remember, they're animals and we're humans. And we don't need to get that confused. And the Pharisees were confused. They thought the sheep was more valuable than the man. So Jesus went ahead and healed the man right in front of them. Putting an exclamation mark on his lesson, isn't he? He's just saying, you want to, okay, right here, I'll do it, just to show you it's okay to do it. And you know, instead of rejoicing about the fact that this man who was sick, he'd had a withered up hand, instead of rejoicing that his hand was healed and fully whole, and he'd be able to go get a job now, and he'd be able to provide for his family, and those, oh, isn't that, I mean, isn't this wonderful things happen when somebody gets healed? Instead of that, and what the Pharisees do? They go right out and get together and talk about how they're going to destroy Jesus. Well, yeah, you got to destroy a guy who goes around helping people. Don't want somebody going around helping people. That's a horrible thing. You see how confused they are about what's good and what's evil? They've got it all backwards. Then Jesus leaves. He goes away. Now we've got to understand, Jesus wasn't a coward. He's not running. He's not afraid of them or anything like that. But He knows that they have the power and that at some point they will take His life. And it's not time yet. He's still got more work to do. So He leaves. And it also shows that, you know, He's not the type of person to cause excess strife. The crowds are on His side. They follow Him. It's amazing. Popularity wanes so quickly. These same people, some of them, not everyone certainly, but a lot of these same people that followed Him, were fed by Him, were healed by Him, and cheered Him, well, in less than 2 years from this point right here in Matthew 12, in less than 2 years from this day, they're going to be screaming out, "Crucify Him." And yet He loved them anyway. He healed them anyway. He kept helping them anyway. Says something about who He really was. He'd tell them, don't tell who I am when He healed them. He still had work that needed to be done. And then we see that this is all actually, this attempt to avoid the controversy, avoid the strife, was actually a fulfillment of some prophecy from Isaiah chapter 42. Even as far back as Isaiah's time, God was revealing that His plan ultimately was going to include the Gentiles as well as the Jews. And Jesus wasn't an accident. He wasn't just some guy that got the idea that He should go about teaching. He planned to come. He was chosen, Isaiah 42:1 says, and pleased the Father. He received God's Spirit. And we see all that taking place. We see it at His baptism. A similar statement to this is made, only there, instead of saying He's His servant, God says, "This is My beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased." Not My servant in whom I'm well pleased, but He's My Son. You know, as Christians, as servants of God, we're not to be violent. We're not to be the causers of strife. We're not to be the instigators of problems. And Paul uses this similar kind of language with Timothy in 2 Timothy 2:24 to talk about the peaceful nature of God's servants. The tenderness and care of Jesus is revealed in this prophecy as well. A bruised reed He won't break. And you see how tender He is with hurting people. Now He's strong. He's tough with the tough guys like the Pharisees. He's tough with them. But oh, He's so tender with the wounded. And He helps them. And He heals them. And then in verse 21, we'll close with this verse tonight. "The Gentiles shall trust in His name," Isaiah says. Gentiles. That's us.
Where would we be without Jesus? In Ephesians 2:11 through 14, if you haven't read that in a while, that passage will remind you where you'd be without Jesus. As a Gentile, you'd be nowhere. He says, you know, you were without hope. You were without God. You had nothing without Jesus Christ. But now, because of Jesus Christ, you can come near to God. For 2,000 years, from the time of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, till the time of Christ, the Jews and Gentiles had separated ways. They had become two separate groups of people moving down the streams of civilization. But there at Christ, they came back together to bring one, to bring unity. Do you remember when the Berlin Wall fell? Remember seeing that? Do you remember watching that? Do you remember hearing the stories about the people who had been separated for about 40 years from after World War II, when they built that wall overnight, put that fence up and the, you know, and the wire and the guards, and had separated families and friends that didn't get to see each other for 40 years. And you remember the heart-touching stories about those people getting to get back together and see their friends and family members again, and the heart-breaking stories of some who found out that in that time many of their friends and family members had died and they didn't get back together with them when the walls came down. See, I think about that when I think about Jesus tearing down that middle wall of partition that separated the Jews from the Gentiles for all those years. And now, in Christ, we can come together. We can be one. What a difference Jesus makes. He is our peace who has made both one. He's our hope. He is the one in whose name we, as Gentiles, well, the Jews too now though, have to trust. Are you trusting in Jesus? I mean, fully trusting in Jesus? Do you really fully trust Him? You need to. You need to check your heart and see if you're trusting Him like you should. He's the only Savior we have. There is no hope in any other. There is no other name under heaven whereby we must be saved. He's the only one. He's it. We talked about Hebrews 10 last night. If we reject Christ, if we trample His blood underfoot, that's it. He's the only sacrifice there is. There's no other sacrifice for sin. That's it. Let's be sure that we're trusting in Jesus. If you need to respond to God's invitation tonight, please do so.